Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. Happy Anticipation Day.
Well, a very happy Anticipation Day to you, my friend. We're creating a new holiday here on the program tonight, so it's in its early days. We don't know for sure what day it's on. It came on a Wednesday this year. We don't know if that it'll always be the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. We have to think about all that. But I think before we go anywhere else with it, my understanding is that you've got some issues with the name.
Absolutely. Now, first, we should say that we are not inventing an Anticipation Day because we have a problem with Thanksgiving.
Certainly not. Certainly not.
We're very thankful for lots of things. Thanksgiving, it's about you're thankful for things that have been present in your life, and maybe things that people perhaps that even are long past. A lot of it is backward looking, isn't it? So
exactly right. Well, in fact, we've done Thanksgiving shows before. I was looking back over last year's, and I thought, really, we're talking about things that we're looking forward to being thankful for. We should just go ahead and talk about it in those terms. Let's have a future tense Thanksgiving. So, what do they say that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery? So Anticipation Day hardly a knock down on Thanksgiving. It's a tribute to Thanksgiving. It's an all new sexy immortal kind of a Thanksgiving, if you will.
But maybe we should just call it it's. Here's my thing.
Okay.
I thought that Anticipation Day, we might do better with the name of this day if we called it Hope Day or something, because anticipation, you can anticipate things that are bad. You could anticipate a trip to the dentist and not be looking forward to it at all. Whereas hope is always a positive thing, right? You are anticipating something that's good. So I don't know. I'm just throwing that out as a...
I will take that under advisement, and we'll run it past the committee. There's some other possibilities. We might call it Looking Forward Day. I mean, there are possibilities. Hope Day is nice because it's just such a short name, right? Hope Day.
Yeah. Well, and if we decided to just it'd be always a Thanksgiving Eve kind of thing, the day before Thanksgiving, that works out nicely. It's always on a Wednesday prior to Thanksgiving. That might be kind of a nice thing. We're kind of looking forward to Thanksgiving. That's an anticipation thing, and further too, looking forward to lots of things in the future. So
let me tell you one of the things I was thinking. Actually, one of the things I'm looking forward to, hoping for. Anticipating, if you will. Actually, this is kind of a riff on the idea of looking forward. I think it would be great to look forward to seeing everybody's Christmas decorations after Thanksgiving. Does this bother anybody else? I'm like, all my neighbors, not all of them, like a disturbingly large percentage of my neighbors have Christmas lights up all of a sudden, right? Like in the last couple of days, it's been warm and they've been out putting Christmas lights up. And I'm like, it's not even Thanksgiving yet, It's not even Anticipation Day yet, right? And you're putting up...
Exactly.
I feel like you got to give these other holidays their due before you put up their lights. Wouldn't it make it more special if you would hold off on the on the Christmas lights.
Yeah,
throwing that out.
Yeah, there were some actual Christmas lights in on one street I passed here in Shreveport prior to Halloween. Now I can't even, what are we doing here? You know, is it, you know, you got to have Christmas lights after Labor Day? I mean, what's going to come to, you know? It's
exactly.
Yeah, we
probably sound like old guys. No? We're just proud to the old guys complaining.
Yeah,
about
that's right. You know, no, Christmas lights go up the week before Christmas, and get off my lawn, kids. You know, that's pretty
exactly.
Much
you know, we put the tree up on the 23rd. We take it down on January 1st, and we wouldn't look at it most of the time. It was up either. So
that's right. Yeah, because you don't want it to grow.
Okay, let's get back into the spirit of the program, because what we're talking about is things that we're looking forward to seeing happen. And I put that up on Facebook. We got some great suggestions from some of my friends on things that people are looking forward to. And that's really kind of what this show is so often about. We talk about the future, but we've got a pretty positive spin on the future, and there are a lot of developments that we're keen to see moving ahead. We're keen to see progress in them. So I thought this would be a fun opportunity to take, we could each take two or three of those and talk about what it is we hope to see happen. And I think one of them kind of it started down that old garden path, right? It turned into an almost a kind of a Facebook flame war there for a minute. So,
Yeah, it did. And it was,
Stephen, thanks a lot for that. So why don't we begin with that?
I threw it out. One of the things that I threw out that I would love to see, I'm anticipating, I'm hoping for, is that we find, you know, that there are they're discovered truly effective treatments for obesity. Now, here's my thing, Phil. More than half of all Americans are obese. And obesity has some serious health consequences. You know, your chances of becoming diabetic, having heart disease, high blood pressure, joint problems, pretty much all the illnesses.
Colon cancer, pancreatic cancer. There is a long list of things.
It goes on and on. All the illnesses of modern life, practically. You're at higher risk for if you're obese, and the more obese you are, the more you're at risk for these things. And so,
right.
You know, my thought is, hey, you know, give me something besides speed. You know, I mean, that's pretty much, you know, in the past, what did people take in the 70s if they, you know, for obesity? Well, it was pretty much amphetamines, right? And then, then we flirted around with a group of drugs, like FinFin and stuff that, you know, would pretty much do your heart in. Not an improvement at all. There's been a few other things that have been strides. I would say it's safe to say that we still have not, we don't have a handle on this thing. If we had a handle on it, there wouldn't be so many fat people, in Walmart, look around, there's some fat people in this world. And, I think that most
there
of
are
them
quite
would
a few.
Prefer to be thinner.
Well, now here
yeah.
you go. Jab in the chat room has already pointed out, Stephen, there is already a cure. This was pointed out on Facebook. There is a cure
yeah.
for obesity. If people would just eat right and exercise. Okay. So what do you have to say to that? That's all people have to do is do that, and then there wouldn't be an obesity problem. Problem solved.
Let's just throw it out that obesity is behaviorally related.
Yeah,
would you agree with
question.
That, Bill?
You know what? I have been obese. I've dealt with overweight my entire adult life. I have been up to, if you use life insurance tables, I was saying before the show, I think probably about 130 pounds overweight. So I am on the record saying that my behavior was contributory to that, if not downright causal to that. I don't deny that choices that I made had a lot to do with the fact that I was significantly overweight for a good portion of my life. Yes. Sorry, that was a long way of saying yes.
Yes, and I would join you in that, Phil. That's been my experience as well. I've been more overweight than I am now. I've been in a lot better shape than I'm in now. I'm, I'm probably halfway to where I need to be, you know, at this moment in time. Maybe not quite halfway there, And so I would say behavior has a lot to do with that. But it's not just an issue of willpower. If it was just an issue of willpower, then anyone who has will, you know, has a demonstrated ability to exercise willpower, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would you know, there would be no risk of them ever being obese. You know, if a person you know, is you know, I don't know, done something extraordinary in their life that required a lot of willpower, then you say, yeah, but that person obviously, you know, they've got it. They don't, you know, there's no risk of them being obese. But I know lots of people that are accomplished in, you know, professionally, or they're very intelligent, and they've done all kinds of neat and interesting things in their life, and they are fat as they can be. So you know, it's more than just an issue of willpower. And you know, and I would say that, you know, exercise, you know, you could spend a lot of time on the treadmill and not lose a lot of weight. I don't know what I'm trying to get at here, Phil, but it's not an easy thing to do. And
it's really not. I mean, you know, that sums it up. I think the actual issue is that when you talk about eating right and exercise, which, by the way, although you and I are both advocates of medical interventions for obesity, we're both big time advocates of exercise and eating right. I think we've talked about it numerous times on this program, and the Speculist. Not down on those things, not down on people making good, responsible choices, eating nutritious food, eating the right amounts of food. That's all right. That's all the correct things to do. One thing you have to observe is there's a big, big difference between preventing becoming obese in the first place and what you do about to not be obese anymore once you're there. People think that prevention and the cure are the same thing. And, you know, because they're both related to the same condition, it seems logical. But actually, they're not all that closely linked. The truth is, it's kind of like you can prevent the flu by keeping your hands clean, right? Wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your hands, and you can keep yourself from getting the flu if you do that.
Yeah.
But once
yeah.
you have the flu, you can wash your hands all you want. You've still got the flu. You know what I mean? It's sometimes the things you do to prevent something from happening, and the things that have to take place in order to cure the condition are completely different. And Sally has mentioned the magic word there in the chat room, and it's metabolism. People who are obese have very, you know, I mean, I don't know any other word to say it, and since I myself have suffered from this condition, I feel, you know, that I'm not insulting anyone, damaged metabolisms. You know, they don't respond as well to the kinds of things that people would typically advocate as the cure for obesity as thin people do. So I think probably in some sense, probably a lot easier to stay thin than it is to get thin. Not to say that people who are thin don't work hard at it, that they don't exercise, they don't eat right, that they're not well-disciplined people. I don't judge anyone in this, right? I make no judgments. I don't think it's easy for anybody, and I don't think anybody's bad, right?
I can tell you
some people. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Stephen.
I was just going to say the only body that I've walked around in is my own, you know. So.
Exactly, yeah. You know, I know it's hard for me not to be fat. That's the one thing I can say with absolute certainty, that it ain't easy. There is a book that we talked about once on the show, I think about a year ago, and that still remains relevant to this discussion, and I highly recommend it. It's called Why We Get Fat by Gary Taubes, and he does an exhaustive review of the medical literature on this issue, on medical studies, treatments for obesity. And the treatments that are almost always given are either diet or exercise or the combination of the common sense approach. This is how we're going to help people lose weight. And ladies and gentlemen, it just doesn't work very well. That's the bottom line. If you look at the medical research literature, if you look at the studies that have been done, the clinical trials that have been done, where people have gone on these programs, they've stayed on them, and they've sometimes have lost significant amounts of weight, sometimes not so much. The exercise studies, they really have a hard time getting people to lose weight. There's one study in there, in fact, about people who became marathon runners, and they're like running these, you know, 25-mile races, and they're getting pretty good. You know, they're building up their speed and all that kind of stuff, and still having a really hard time losing any weight. curing obesity is not the same as preventing it. Bottom line, they're two different medical facts, and when you're trying to cure it, you're up against a much more difficult thing. So what happens is, in most of these studies, you see a rate of about 90 to 95% failure. So within 5 years after the people went on the program, 90 to 95 out of 100 have regained the weight or are fatter than they were when it started. So what that tells me is that if the willpower argument is right, okay, and people just aren't trying hard enough, right? And let's give it full benefit of the doubt and say it's 90%, okay, 90% failure. So let's say that we could really, you know, just double down, double our efforts. We could get people really motivated, get people really excited about willpower, and we could do twice as well, right? And so that would mean that 20% would succeed and 80% would fail. So even if you could get up to like five times, if you could get diet and exercise to work five times as well as it currently does. What did you say, Stephen? Half of the country is obese?
Yeah. Half okay. Is actually more than half.
50% of so 300 million people, half of that's 150 million. So 75 million of them would benefit. 75 million people would still be obese. Okay, that's the fact. Okay, even if diet and exercise worked five times as well as it currently does, you'd have 75 million people facing, as you mentioned earlier, heart disease, colon cancer, diabetes, joint problems, all these other issues. Just from a public policy standpoint, if there's something else we can do for these people, we should do it. Even if it's just a problem of willpower, even if it's just the fact that these people are lazy, okay? Even if you can't see it in any other light, then they're just a bunch of lazy, undisciplined slobs. If you have to look at it that way, and I don't think people do have to look at it that way, but even if you do look at it that way, you go, okay, so what? Those 75 million people all need to get sick and die? I mean, I don't see how anyone could really feel that way. You know, it seems to me if there are alternatives, then we need to pursue them. And I agree with
that. There happen to be a few.
There have to be some. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to point, Brian Wong, who has been a frequent co-host and guest on this program, has written extensively about one thing that he's looking forward to seeing is myostatin inhibition, which will allow us to be more muscular. Well, when we're more muscular, the more muscle mass that we have, the more our bodies need, of blood sugar, and it'll go, our bodies go to the fat stores and pull the blood sugar out, and people get thinner the more buff they are, and so that's one way to address it would be to make us more muscular. There are other possibilities. There's carbohydrate binding. There's various studies showing how carbohydrates could be bound chemically and then pass through without being absorbed. Or perhaps another method instead of binding the carbohydrate would be to alter the receptors within our own gastrointestinal system so that it doesn't pass into the bloodstream, carbohydrates and other things like that. So that's there are possibilities. There are ways that we can engineer ourselves or to change the way food acts within our gastrointestinal system get more buff. There are ways to address this. So
I especially like the idea of touching the fat receptor genes, making the body not so eager to make fat, and myostatin inhibition. We've got this chemical in our bodies called myostatin does it serve any purpose other than make it hard for us to get muscle? That's pretty much what it does, right?
There's a reason why you wouldn't want to limit the amount of muscle that you have. If you are living on the Serengeti and you are starving, and every meal is saving your life, every meal you have.
Yeah, what you just explained, Stephen, is there's a reason why my remote ancestors wanted to inhibit the amount of muscle they would grow, right? Not why I would want to. You see, that's the issue.
Exactly. You are not starving to death. You and me, Phil, we're not worried about our next meal. we're a little more worried about the effects of being fat on our health. And so
our you know, bodies are ridiculously good at building fat, and yeah. some more than others. I mean, in the chat room, they're talking about genetic factors. There's a whole host of factors, right? There's all kinds of environment and behavior and genetics. I mean, it's one of these really complicated things. And because it's one of those really complicated things, everybody wants to get it down to a pat answer. And I don't think, you know, I don't think there is a pat answer. But for sure, our bodies conspire against us. Our bodies, we are descended from the people who survived, and survival was, you know, the trait that was selected in favor of was if you could keep fat in your body, bottom line.
Yeah.
You know, if you keep fat in your body long enough to reproduce, you survive. And so when you select in favor of that trait after generation after generation after generation, here we are in a kind of a post-famine world in the West. Obviously, there's still famine going on in Africa right now, which is a horrible situation. But in the civilized, you know, world, absent war, absent terrible things going on, people don't face famine. We face an abundance of food, and we face a body that is trying to put fat on itself all the time. It makes, you know, there is, within the willpower argument, I think there is a component of this should be hard. There's an argument that it's somehow morally better if it's hard. And my answer to that is math would be morally better, I guess, without a calculator. But I'll use the calculator, okay? It would, in some sense, be morally better if I walked 2 miles to the office rather than rode in a car. But I'm going to ride in a car, right? I mean, this is why we have technology, right? So you know, if you want to make a case that it's morally superior to lose weight through diet and exercise, or just, you know, self-recrimination, you know, fine, go for it, make that argument. I'm going to say if 75 million people or more could have their lives vastly improved and their health vastly improved through resetting some dials that we set, you know, tens of thousands of years ago to prevent problems we don't have anymore, I could not possibly be more okay with that. All right, I'm totally fine with that. I think it's a good idea.
Well, that's awesome, and yeah, you know, Phil, there are other subjects we probably should hit in anticipation day, and maybe get off this subject since this one is just so much. Yeah, we're about to sit down.
We could do a whole show on this, but we've got other things. We've got other things to anticipate. Let's get back into the spirit of the holiday. Stephen, why do we always fight on Anticipation Day? Can I ask you that?
We're going to save it for Festivus and air our grievances.
We'll have our airing of grievances, and then followed by the feats of strength, and everything will be. What else happened on? I can't remember. You put a poll up, right?
That's right. There's a Festivus poll. But you know, with the feats of strength will be vastly improved by myostatin inhibition as well. So you know, this
exactly.
is just something that needs to happen. And
that's exactly
so
right.
But
then some people will say it's not as worth as much because we, you know,
anyway.
It's a morally inferior feat of strength. Okay, so here you go. I'm going to switch to one of my favorites, and something I'm very much looking forward to. I had on my list is space tourism. And if you've not been to the Virgin Galactic site, visit the Virgin Galactic website. You know, this is Richard Branson's business. They're leveraging the Spaceship One technology, and they're planning on selling tickets, I guess, now at this point, for people to travel into space for fun, right? I mean, not for scientific reasons or not to, you know, to prove any government point or, you know, to deploy any technology or anything other than just because these are people who want to go into space, and so they're going to get to go. This is a new business. I mean, it's a new business model. I don't think we're going to see a lot of activity in it over the next couple or 3 years. I would say within a decade it will be happening, and certainly within the next couple, 3 decades, it will become a fairly common thing. But here's what I anticipate. This is the thing I really look forward to. If you go to the Virgin Galactic website, open up the PDF brochure. I just love that there's a brochure for a company that sells tours into space. I'm just – talk about Thanksgiving. I am grateful that I live in an era when there's a company selling tickets into space, and you can look at their brochure. I just think that's totally cool.
But Phil, you know, I mean, you're supporting, you know, the 1%. The rest of us, we're the 99%, Phil, that can't get into space, and so we should dislike it for that reason.
Well, okay, but you know what? We're not going to have everything be an argument tonight, Stephen. This is
exactly.
Look, my point is I'm going to get into the 1% and I'm going to fly into space. Okay, that's my idea.
Well, here's the thing. You know, obviously, a lot of things start off benefiting the wealthy before they filter down to the rest of us. But you know, hey, who cares? You know, I mean, let the wealthy have it first, and then economies of scale will bring it to the rest of us. So,
I agree. I mean, there was a time when automobiles only belonged to the 1%, and now we all have one, right? TVs, same thing.
Right.
I mean, personal computers. This is the way it has typically worked. And I won't mind if the model eventually for most space tourism ends up being the lighter than air model that we talked about a couple weeks ago. I think that would actually be quite cool. But what I was going to say about the brochure, and I agree with you, I agree. There will be early adopters, there will be rich people, and then it becomes a broader and broader, and it ultimately becomes a mass market thing. You know, will I live to see that day? I hope so. You know, I plan to. But if you look at that brochure, there is a view of Earth that is shown about, two-thirds of the way through. And you just look at that and you go, yeah, I want to be up that high and I want to see that. I want to go into space and see the same thing that the astronauts have all seen on the shuttle or, you know, in the early Mercury and Gemini missions, even the Apollo missions before they would deploy out further into on their way to the moon. So that's what I'm looking forward to. I'm looking forward to traveling into space for fun. I like going to the beach. I think beaches make a great vacation. I think the mountains make a great vacation, and I look forward to going into space on vacation. So that's my first item. Let's keep working through these. We've got quite a few to cover yet.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned self-driving cars, I believe, right, Phil? That was one that was on your list, and so let's go ahead and get into that a little bit.
By all means.
John,
go ahead. If you got something, what I was going to say is, do you know that GM now says that we'll have self-driving cars on the road by 2020?
I'm not at all surprised. It's amazing. And the reason it's happening is because they pretty much have a handle on how much computation will be involved in this, and they. They can kind of forecast, what the cost of such systems will be using Moore's law. We can kind of know, how much it will cost, and it'll be cheap enough to it'll just be an additional option, you know, by that time. So, it's pretty amazing. But we already have self-parking cars and cars that can do various things. So I mean, just. It's not surprising in one way, but in another way, it's one of those things that goes, you kind of go, yeah, now I'm living in the future. We've made it,
yeah.
A little bit like Siri talking phone,
Exactly. You see these things kind of adding up, right? Here's the brochure from the company that wants to sell you a ticket into space. Here's the car that drives itself. Here's the phone you can have, a telephone you can have a conversation with, and there's nobody else there. It's just the phone you're talking to, right? I mean, that's...
Exactly.
That is pretty futuristic stuff right there. Well, one of the issues that comes up, and I had linked to this Slate article in the email I sent you about this, and it also came up on Facebook when I was promoting this show, is the issue of people giving up their control of their vehicle.
I find it hilarious, Phil, that not hilarious, it's more telling that the same guy that had an issue with finding effective treatments for obesity was also the guy saying self-driving cars, no, I don't want them. I want to be able to do my own driving.
Those go together very well, right? That he's a Coloradan man. Okay, he's a rugged out in Coloradan, right?
He's an individualist.
Car,
and
you get
wet,
fat, you need to go run, right?
It's the can-do Western spirit,
I understand that viewpoint completely.
Right.
And so actually it raises the – I understand it. I don't completely agree with it, but I do understand. It raises the question, though, will it be optional? Can you still drive, or are we facing a world where we won't be able to drive anymore because the cars will be doing all the driving? I think there's one scenario where that happens. And
can
Stephen,
I answer as an attorney? I'm going to give you the lawyer's answer, okay?
Okay.
What I think, looking forward, here's what I see. I see a period of time where we begin to see these systems, but there's kind of a backlash against them legally as, some accidents result as from failures of some of these systems. Of course, the systems continue to improve very fast, whereas we human drivers will not. And it'll quickly be determined that these systems are better at driving than we are. And then we kind of coexist driving some for a period of time. We drive some, the systems drive some. But at some point, we as a society are going to get, are going to say, well, we've got these systems that can do our driving for us. They're so much more safer, so much more safe than we are.
Right.
And we're losing 30,000 people a year on the highways.
Right.
At one time it was even higher. It was more like 50,000, which is like the entire Vietnam War annually.
Every year.
And now, due to some safety features in cars and seatbelt laws and things like that, we've got it down to 30,000. But good grief, 30,000 people, the only reason we put up with it is because we can't see a society without it. I mean, we can't imagine doing without our cars. And so what if we could have our cars and do without the 30,000, deaths? I think at some point it'll just be that we'll get in our cars and there won't be a steering wheel there. We'll tell it where to
go.
Because it'll be just like just like seatbelt laws. It'll be safer to have the cars do the driving for us.
Yeah, so the lawyer answer is the same answer I was going to give. Yeah, once it becomes clear that having people operate vehicles is the less safe alternative, is the hazardous alternative, is the one that's costing, a great toll in human life, we're going to be eliminated from the picture. It's just, it's sad because we enjoy driving. I like driving, but I think I don't mind being driven around that much. If I'm in the car by myself, I will probably be able to find other things to do. I'll have my Kindle Fire with me or the, 8 year from now equivalent of that, which will probably be a very entertaining device, I'm thinking. And we'll spend our time being driven around, probably doing other things, talking to people or reading or, working. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we could do rather than driving, which won't feel as satisfying as driving. I can understand the objection, but I think that the toll in human, I mean, it goes back to the obesity issue. It's like ultimately people are just worth a lot. Not having people die is a really good thing. Not having people die in traffic accidents is an extremely good thing. And if you ultimately took the steering wheels out of cars, you would end the whole possibility of drunk driving, right? I mean, it just wouldn't happen anymore.
Exactly. Now, and the drunk may tell the car the wrong place to take him. But
you still have that going on, that could happen.
I could see that happening. But beyond that, it's going to be you couldn't have an accident because of it. And that's huge. That alone, if all you did was eliminate death due to intoxication, that's probably half your fatalities or more right there. So that's huge. I think that 20, 30 years from now, most cars will not have steering wheels, and we'll just tell our cars where to take us. But there'll be closed tracks. It'll be for those of us who really love driving, there'll probably be places that can be done, and it'll be similar to auto racing. You can't race on the highways legally, but you can race on closed tracks, and I think
there'll be closed tracks where
driving.
People can drive. Or, if you own a farm or something, surely you'd still be able to drive a vehicle around your own property or something like that, I'm sure. But
you might have to special order a car that would have a steering wheel and controls.
Right,
either
just
that
like
or
you can
have,
own a race
own
car,
a
if, you,
car.
You know, if you're a hobbyist. So,
yeah.
I think that the pleasure of driving is the big loss, but the gain in time and the reduction in stress, you know, and just the feeling that, I've got this time, I can do something else with it, and nothing bad is going to happen, you know, because there's always this possibility of something horrible happening when you're in a car. You have to be aware of that all the time, right? Because it's not just that you might make a mistake. I don't worry about myself making a mistake all that much. I'm a pretty cautious driver. But there's, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? A lot of bozos out there, right? And
right.
How nice would it feel to be out on the road knowing that there's no more bozos out there, that every, you know, agent driving every vehicle is as smart as everyone else and as concerned about my safety as I am. It's a really appealing idea. So it's a future I'm greatly looking forward to. Okay, so let's talk about other things we're anticipating. Stephen, one that that you had mentioned that I think bears some discussion is moving beyond antibiotics for infections. What do you got in mind there?
Well, you know, there's an antibiotic arms race is what we're having with various bacteria. Come up with an antibiotic. It works for a while, but what happens is that the most of the population of this particular bacteria is wiped out by this antibiotic. But a few of these little critters have a resistance to the antibiotic. Well, guess what you select for then? You are selecting for those critters that can resist it. And so the next generation, they're all descended from that, from those little guys. And all of a sudden you've got a population of bacteria that can resist the antibiotic. So what do? We come up with a new antibiotic, and then, you know, and round and round we go. That's what we're seeing. And unfortunately, it seems like that we've got some bugs now that are resistant to everything, and it's pretty scary. So what's the next step? We could come up with stronger antibiotics for a time, perhaps, but the ultimate idea, and DARPA is working on this, is to come up with nanoparticles that just burst the cell walls, can seek out and determine what is a bacteria in your body, leave the other cells of your body alone, but then burst the cell walls of bacteria. You know, adapt for that, you suckers.
Wow.
You know, I mean, that, you know, once the cell walls are destroyed, then, you know, those guys are dead, and I don't know about you, but I don't think that I can come up with a strategy for these guys to adapt to that. And so and the other thing is that it could be kind of almost a universal drug. You got some infection, we don't even need to know what it is anymore. You know, zap, you take this, and it seeks out whatever is foreign to you and does away with it. And so that's the idea, and that's what DARPA is working on.
What's beautiful about that is there's no way for bacteria, there's no way for anything to evolve around that, right? You in the arms race for good, for sure, if you do this. Is that right?
Well, my thought is there's perhaps one way. I've thought about this a bit. What if the bacteria, you know, evolved to look more like our human cells, so that the differentiation became more and more difficult? So, I don't know. It seems though that this is a major, major step forward, and it would be a very hard thing to begin to adapt around this. So, you know, maybe there's a way for these bacteria to make a comeback with this kind of medicine. But I think it would be a tough. This is a tough one.
It would be a lot harder. You certainly wouldn't have this massive escalation that you see going on now. That's for sure. So,
right.
I think just in that sense, it would be better. And also the idea of one treatment that hits everything, right? Because there's always this odd thing about, well, no, not this antibiotic, you want this one. No, actually not that one, you want this one, but this dose of it. But here we're talking about you got one little machine that is good for anything.
That's right. And I can imagine you wouldn't even wait until you're sick, you know. Maybe you periodically get an injection just to, you know, prophylactic care, you know, just, you know, probably most of the time we're walking around with one infection or another, you know. And so, you know, just from time to time, just go get a little shot, and whatever it is that's ailing you, that's good for it, you know. So
good stuff. All right. Yeah. Well, that's one to look forward to.
Sure. I anticipate. I hope for that.
I hope for that one too. That sounds good to me. Well, speaking of medical stuff, I'm looking forward to. I'm anticipating. I'm hoping for a cure for cancer. Now, we've talked about cancer on the program numerous times. We had Dr. Jing Sui on talking about his unique methodology that he's developing built around the immune system. And last week I saw a movie about a fella named Brzezinski. Have you heard of this guy? He is a kind of an independent medical researcher in Texas who has fought this like long-standing battle, first with the Texas Medical Board and then with the FDA. Has won to continue providing this treatment that he's been working on for the last 30 years, which is a very interesting kind of a chemically based form of gene therapy. He discovered a set of peptides in the human blood that had never been isolated before. I guess he found these back in the 70s or 80s, and he did some further research and observed that people with cancer don't ever have these in their body. That healthy people have them. People with cancer don't have them. He thought that was pretty interesting. So he came up with this idea of, let's start treating people who have cancer with these peptides that he identified. And lo and behold, he's had some pretty astounding results in terms of treating cancer. It's not a slam dunk. It's not like everybody who goes down there, you know, walks away cancer free. But according to the movie, the clinical trials that he's done, and he's actually fought off both the Texas medical authorities and the FDA to the point where now everything he does is an officially, legally sanctioned FDA clinical trial. So they're gathering tons and tons of data on this, but he's showing consistently a higher survival rate than what you see from radiation and chemotherapy. And in some of the more aggressive forms of cancer, it's really interesting to see that you look at the treatment that people are getting via radiation, and you go, okay, well, it looks like 10% of them, you know, it's like really depressing statistics. 10% of them actually got their cancer wiped out. You know, it's like 90%. You know, this is like the obesity thing we were talking about before. You know, it's not a terribly effective treatment. 10% got their cancer wiped out. But then 5 years later, even those 10% are dead because the radiation killed them. It's a matter of if the cancer doesn't get you, I mean, you've heard this before, right? The chemo kills you or the radiation kills you, and that actually happens. By the time you subtract out the rate of the people who don't survive this really intense chemo and radiation, the conventional treatments for cancer, some forms, you know, some do pretty well, and there are new treatments coming on, so I don't mean to be terribly negative, but some forms of cancer, it's not terribly effective. Well, what you see with this is these things don't hurt you, right? So he might have only a, you know, whereas the approved methodology gives you a 10% recovery, he might get like a 22% recovery, but they all live, right? None of them die from the chemo or from the radiation, because all he's done is put back into their bodies things that should have been there before. And apparently what these peptides do is they operate on the genes in the same way that gene therapies that are now being developed for cancer operate on the genes. But unlike the gene therapies that are currently being developed, which will isolate a particular gene and work on it one at a time, these peptides, apparently they'll go after like a whole cluster. They go after a whole family. And have proved very, very effective. So I think it's really exciting that you hear about something like this. You know, it's just a couple years ago we heard about Dr. Sui. You learn about this, and it makes me think there must be four or five more things like this going on in the world that we haven't stumbled upon yet. But between people working on the immune system, working on novel approaches to gene therapy, improving how we deliver remedies that we already have, and then I think the big kahuna, the one that's really going to push us over the top, nanotechnology, ultimately nanomedicine, my previous prediction on cancer was that within 20 years, it would be a condition that people live with, like diabetes, like people take insulin for diabetes and they can live with it, that people would be no more concerned about cancer than they are diabetes. And I'm going to I'm going to have to raise my own bet on that. And I think within 20 years, or when did I make that, 2 years ago?
So yeah, within 18 years.
Okay, within 18 years, I think most cancer is going to be gone. I think that most cancer will be cured. It looks to me like we are closing in on it's like we're unlocking it.
We got it surrounded. Maybe we got the problem, we're coming at the problem about four or five different directions, and it might be that when you come down with cancer, your treatment will consist of three or four of these things.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. It could be that you need an immune burst, or it could be that you need peptides to act on certain genes, or it could be that you need a more advanced version of this thing that you're talking about DARPA's developing to fight bacteria. Things that could fight bacteria ultimately could become something that could fight cancer cells. But one way or another, I think that cancer is going to be cured, and that's something I look very much forward to. I think it's going to be a completely treatable, completely curable, most forms. You know, I won't say that there will be no death from cancer at all 18 years from now, but it will be largely cured, that the news of someone dying from cancer will become as strange to us as the news of someone dying from, like, measles, right? It would just be like,
and wow. I would just add one limitation, and I would join you with one additional limitation to what you just said. I would say in the developed world.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Well, which is where people get cancer. Let's face it. I mean, it's really our problem. Although as the less developed world becomes more developed, they're starting to deal with it too. And actually, the other big caveat: if you watch this movie, you should check out this movie. It's on. It's available on Netflix for those who use like on a Roku or a game device. It's just called Brzezinski. It's the guy's name is the name of the movie. It seems like one of the biggest obstacles right now is just the government. I mean, you know, it feels like the bureaucracy is opposed to this guy, not on the grounds that they think his stuff doesn't work. They hardly even want to talk about that. It's just more like he's kind of a threat to them. You know, really interesting to watch. The whole thing kind of unfolds. It's almost like if Michael Crichton were still alive, he could have written this as a novel. This guy comes up with this cure for cancer. Then you've got this government agency trying to shut him down. Then you've got another government agency in bed with a pharma company who were trying to steal his patents. And one of the researchers who worked for him went to work for them. And you know, there's a lot of intrigue and a lot of like stuff going on, kind of under the table and behind closed doors. And of course, it's one filmmaker's view of what's taking place. But it almost seems like the medical infrastructure, like the medical/legal infrastructure, is as big a hindrance to us getting to my scenario of cured cancer as any of the medical obstacles would be. I think we're going to overcome those. I hope we can overcome the bureaucratic obstacles. Hopefully those don't become the biggest ones of all.
Well, let me jump into one that is tied very closely with the cancer issue.
Okay.
Something I'm looking forward to is treatment for aging. Aging, if the obesity doesn't get us, if the cancer doesn't get us, then we all get old and die. You know, I mean, it's these are things that kill us, right?
Right.
There is one theory out there is that cell senescence, something that our bodies do is the reason we get old. You know, our cells are programmed to die at a certain point, to self-destruct in a way. And one of the theories is that it's a evolved response to keep us from dying of cancer younger than we would die of old age. Aging is the body's response to keep us alive longer than we would have been alive otherwise.
Right.
It is part of the fight against cancer that is ongoing in our bodies. So, if that is true, then one of the prerequisites to really getting a handle on, you know, aging and rejuvenation therapy you know, is that it may be that curing cancer, or at least in curing cancer in most cases, is a prerequisite to getting our treatments for aging. So,
it's almost two sides of the same coin. I mean,
it is. It's like the radiation in a way. You know, the radiation kills the cancer, but you die of the radiation. Well, aging kills cancer, but you die of the aging eventually. So we have to figure out another way to kill the cancer besides radiation. We need to find another way to kill cancer besides aging. And so once we get a real good handle on the aging, I think we'll be in a better position to really address, you know, if we get a good handle on curing cancer, we'll then have a better shot at curing aging. So, that's one thing I'm looking forward to. But I would have to guess that it would be a decade or two following the getting cancer under control. So,
that's absolutely. Well, I was just noticing in the chat room, Paul Vasquez asks, aging is caused by cancer? I think you're saying kind of the opposite.
No, I'm saying
aging
the opposite.
Cures cancer. Yeah.
Aging is, aging prolongs our life because cells are programmed to die rather than become cancerous.
Right.
And usually that programming works. Usually, most of the cells in your body are going to self-destruct before they can become cancerous. When something starts going wrong in your cells, they're programmed to die instead of becoming a tumor. And thank God for that because, you know, it allows most of us to live to be much older than we would have been otherwise. But aging is something that keeps us alive and addresses the cancer in our bodies, but something that would become cancer otherwise. So we got to cure the cancer.
You know, it's really interesting how they're all kind of tied together, isn't it? And
right.
when you look at the big. I mean, one of the big things we're looking for in the Facebook, Michael threw out the old sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers and said he'd go for any two. And I'm like, yeah, well, just make sure one of the two is immortal so you can work on all the rest of them. You know, you have plenty of time to do it. But,
well, I think it may be that we got to have all of them, you know. To have any of them, we might have to do it all. You know,
it comes as a set. Well, we got one more item on the list, our co-host who has been completely silent, but I did include his picture both at the Speculist and we got a really nice image of him up here on the Fast Forward Radio page for this show. If you're listening to this on archive, I hope you saw that Stephen and I are both pictured as well as our guest. I suppose it would be traditional to refer to this individual as Tom, our co-host. Is that right?
Exactly.
Now, something he's looking forward to, we'll speak on his behalf, is coming breakthroughs in vat-grown meat and poultry and making it possible to enjoy meat without actually having to slaughter animals or slaughter birds. And I just saw today, I don't know if this is a new news story, it was completely new to me, that PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, is offering $1 million push prize for the... for some major breakthrough in vitro meat. And you know what I love about that is I love to see somebody putting a big push prize in place for that. And I look at that and I go, this has got to be the most useful thing PETA has ever done. I'm really impressed that...
I'm actually surprised that they would get behind that meat. To me, I would think that they would look at it and go, ooh, meat. I don't want meat from any source. But I guess they overcame their squeamishness and said, you know, a lot of people are just never going to give up their meat, and so we won't want animals killed. So let's come up with a way that they can have their meat and animals don't have to die. So good for them. Yeah, I don't agree with much they do, but good for them on that.
This is one I can get behind.
I can get behind that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a brilliant move on their part, and I agree. I would not have expected it. And I'm very pleased to see them do it. I think it's a very constructive step. I think it moves us in the right direction. You know, tomorrow is Thanksgiving. I don't know if you saw the cartoon that's been bumping around on Facebook. It's the turkey that's holding the big sign that says "Eat more beef."
I saw another cartoon, Phil. It was it's a blind farmer out in the chicken coop or the turkey coop, and he's got an axe and he's swinging it around, and he's got a cane in one hand and an axe in the other, and all the turkeys are around him, and all the turkeys are going moo moo. I'm sorry, that was probably insensitive to the disabled, but
that is politically incorrect on so many levels.
Yeah, it was a little bit politically incorrect. I'm sorry to my blind listeners out there, but I thought it was kind of cute. But anyway,
the turkeys are just trying. You know, they just want to live. We look forward to Thanksgiving in the future when maybe we can all sit down to a turkey that never suffered any pain. I think that. Whether that comes in vitro or whether we become increasingly humane in how we deal with animals, there's probably a convergence that's likely to occur there. But I think it is a very positive future, one where animals are not mistreated and where they suffer less than they currently do on our behalf. I think that's a good future to look forward to. And with that, I think we're getting pretty close to music time. Stephen, what do we got going on music wise this evening?
Well, you know, when I broaden my horizons to include instrumental music, I can get that from anywhere. It doesn't, you know, I'm not likely to play a French pop song where I can't understand any of the words, but I might play a French instrumental riff, you know, where they're getting down with the guitars, and we can all appreciate that. The name of this song is Bucolic. Bucolic Utopia. So
Colin?
I'm thinking it's like
Bucolic
Utopia. I'm going to go with that. But it's in. That's probably as close to a French equivalent as what English equivalent as we can get. And the artist is Lostana David.
All right. Well, looking forward to our Bucolic Utopia. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks to our friends in the chat room and to all my Facebook friends who helped put the topics together for tonight's program. We'll be back again with another Fast Forward Radio again next week. Hope you'll be able to join us. Everyone, for those who celebrate it, have a happy Thanksgiving. And until next time, live to see it.